evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Stu Weber at StuWeb.com, and it is September the 11th, 2020. And I have a special honor to have Professor Jim Fetcher on and Professor Paul on with me. And we're going to be talking about a terrorist attack that occurred 19 years ago on America. The terrorist attack was the World Trade Center, plus the other building that fell, which was a false flag. And it was done by George Herbert Walker Bush, George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and a host of others, and the Israeli Mossad, and overlays into German intelligence and all kinds of stuff. And one that the terrorist of the Oklahoma City bombing, Jose Padilla, John Doe number two, that was later arrested over his actions in 9-1-1 and spends the rest of his life in jail. But we're going to talk about all the overlays and how we got overturned, how we had a false flag attack. Some people say a bomb went off, dirty bomb in the basement and all the other stuff. Might have, but I'm aware that it was hit with a death ray. And I've had on a lot of experts, know a lot of experts, and had a lot of phone calls right after 9-1-1. Now, I'm not bragging, but I did put out several times about, in the summer, after Tim McVeigh went out the back door and got the trip up to Montana, to Flat Lake, Red Montana, and was verified because the spook helped carrying out of the prison in Tahoe, or whatever it was called, over there in Illinois, or wherever it was at. He was aware of what events happened on 9-1-1. Super spook. Otis Johnson and others told me they hit it with a death ray. Now, I've got Professor James Fetcher on here with me. He's a whistleblower. He sued him over Sandy Hook. He ends up in court, and that makes him officially a whistleblower. But he's blown the whistle on a lot of things. And we've got Paul here with 40 years of knowledge, patriotic knowledge, wisdom and knowledge. So we're going to have a roundtable discussion on these events of the terrorist attack that occurred 19 years ago. Because I want the bastards that were involved in the attack, the false flag attack, I want them to be taken to the firing squad. With that said, welcome, Jim Fetcher. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you.
Jim, tell us what happened. Tell us what happened on 9-1-1. All the investigations you've done. You're one of the top experts on 9-1-1.
Well, to appreciate the full dimensions of 9-11, you want to listen to what Wesley Clark explained at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco in October of 2007. He'd returned to the Pentagon shortly after 9-11 from serving as commanding general Allied Forces Europe, which meant he was Supreme Commander Allied Forces Europe, which meant he was the commanding general of NATO, and encountered a general of his acquaintance who told him that we were about to invade Iraq. They were both surprised because Iraq had nothing to do with 9-11. So Wesley explained to the general, "Well, keep me posted." He saw him again about 2 or 3 months later, and he asked, "Are we still planning to invade Iraq?" And the general said, "Oh, no, sir." He says, "Much worse. Here, step into my office. I've just received a memorandum from the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, that the plan is to take out the governments of 7 countries in the next 5 years." And they both thought, "Why in the world is that?" And the general said, "Oh, I don't know, sir. I guess we're just good at it." And he said, "Well, what countries are those?" And it was beginning with Iraq and Libya and ending with Syria and then confining the Persian nation of Iran. And Clark said, "Well, is it classified?" He said, "Oh, yes, sir." And Clark said, "Well, then don't tell me about it because I may want to talk about it," which 6 years later he did.
Now, was that Secretary Wolfowitz, Undersecretary underneath Rumsfeld, was that the one, the Greater Israel plan you're speaking of, that he wrote?
Well, it was to benefit Israel in the expansion, but it was Rumsfeld himself who directed. I mean, Wolfowitz was a key player in all of this. He'd also been part of the project for a new American century, which was founded in the wake of the demise of the Soviet Union in 1991 to encourage the development of the New American Century, Project for the New American Century, they called themselves, claiming that if only the United States would enter the Middle East and exert military and diplomatic pressure outward from that geopolitically sensitive region, that they could create a new worldwide empire that would endure for the next 100 years. But that was really a fig leaf, because the real enterprise was to expand Israel by using the United States to take out the modern Arab states that had served as a counterbalance to Israel's domination of the entire region. As you know, Stu, the Greater Israel Project involves taking a big chunk of Egypt, about half of Saudi Arabia, most of Syria, good part of Iraq, all of Lebanon, all of Jordan, to create the Greater Israel of Zionist aspirations. Now, these Zionists take a dim view of the United States. Indeed, they take a dim view of all non-Jews. This is a special, virulent version that's based not on the Old Testament, but on the Talmud, that believes in Jewish superiority and an entitlement to the lands of Palestine based on dubious historical arguments, but where Menachem Begin, for example, who was the first one of the first prime ministers of Israel, declared that Jews are superior to the other human races as the human races are superior to the other animals of the earth, including the insects, and that the other races only exist to serve the Jews. You had similar sentiments after 9/11. Ariel Sharon, then the prime minister, said, contrary to the advice of his closest advisors, "We own America, and the Americans know it," to calm concerns that the Americans might figure out that Israel was responsible for 9/11. And where Bibi Netanyahu in 2010 observed in Hebrew, but it was translated, that America is the golden calf, and we're going to break it into parts and milk it dry, and then leave behind the world's largest welfare state, which we will control, because that's what we do with nations we hate. We let them die slowly. It appears that the actual plan was conjured in the mind of Bibi Netanyahu himself in the 1980s, where he held a conference in Jerusalem on terrorism, How the West Can Win, and published a book by that title in 1987. So that with the demise of the Soviet Union, the Project for the New American Century was promoting this idea, but where they went about arranging for an event like this to take place, they talked about in their documents from the Project for a New American Century how, if America were to wake up to the realization it's the only superpower now on Earth, and to make this aggressive move into the Middle East, it could have this opportunity to create an empire that would endure for the next 100 years. But they were concerned the American people might be slow to appreciate the opportunity absent some catalytic and traumatizing event such as a new Pearl Harbor that would bring the message home with powerful effect, and went about arranging for the events of 9/11 with a collaboration from the CIA, then headed by George Tenet, with Dick Cheney and George W. Bush, who had to secure their victory over Al Gore in Florida in order to ensure they could bring us 9/11 with the assistance of Jeb Bush, then Florida's governor, so that they could arrange for this event to take place, where the World Trade Center, which had opened in 1970, was transferred into private hands for the first time by the New York Port Authority, which was dominated by Zionists who wanted to see all of this happen to benefit Israel, into the hands of Silverstein Properties, where it so happened that Larry Silverstein was a very good friend of Bibi Netanyahu, with whom he would have weekly conversations every Sunday. As soon as Silverstein took charge of the property, he fired the security firm that had been looking after the World Trade Center since it first opened and replaced it with an Israeli firm. He also reworked the insurance policy on the World Trade Center to include an anti-terrorist clause such that claiming there had been two attacks by two planes, there were two different attacks, double indemnity, collecting $4.5 billion on a $114 million investment.
Now, if I can stop you just for 1 second, right there, there's a German lawyer. I had a link up at one time, and I'll put it back up. It was on my old site. He had sent me. He sued. He lived in Florida and lived in Germany, and they took his home. They took everything away from him here in the United States because he sued them. But he had the evidence that they were collecting off of six insurance companies, and George Herbert Walker Bush was one of the recipients for insurance on those buildings. I'll get you the stuff on it, Jim. Go ahead.
Oh, well, that's not surprising in the extreme. There were other motives that entered in here. For example, as you're aware, there was a massive gold heist beneath the World Trade Center, but also when Building 7 came down at 5:20 in the afternoon, which was about 7 hours after the destruction of the North Tower, it included the Secret Service office, the FBI office, Securities and Exchange office, where there had been major investigations for five important firms on Wall Street, which were all scrapped in the aftermath. Based on the proposition that the records had been destroyed, it would turn out years and years later, too late to do anything about it after the investigations had been abandoned, that they actually had the records stored digitally in other locations, but it sufficed for the time to accomplish the goals. These were extremely well-built buildings, by the way, where Building 7 was actually a 47-story structure erected over two enormous electrical generators to provide backup electricity for lower Manhattan. It was designed to never collapse, and where the Twin Towers had an ingenious tube-within-a-tube design, 47 massive core columns at the center, connected to 240 external steel support columns by steel trusses filled with concrete from 2 to 4 inches the variance, because it had V-shaped grooves in the trusses that were 2 inches deep, so that in some areas 2 inches, in others 4, because the buildings were 208 feet on a side. Each floor, therefore, represented an acre of concrete on a steel truss. The design of the buildings was so vigorous that it would have been impossible for any real aircraft to actually penetrate the building. They would have crumpled external to the building. The original plan appears to have been to use remotely controlled aircraft, but when they found that real planes would not be able to enter the building, they had to...
You're very correct on this, because my friend John Lear, CI pilot, Area 51, et cetera, I've had him on years ago. He's, you know, in trouble now, but John's father was Lear Jets that later sold the jet company and built the flying saucers, 150 for our U.S. military in 1952. Here's the point. He filed an affidavit as the top-rated pilot in the world. He has every kind of clearance you can imagine, air tower, everything. He said he flew those jets, and he said, Stu, I wrote, examined, those towers were made to take an aircraft hit. And he said, the aircrafts that they're claiming that hit the building, the tail section would have fallen off, broke off, and the wings would have dropped. Neither happened. Go ahead. They were holograms, Jim. Go ahead.
Yeah, there were three different theories about how they faked it, because you have the planes disappearing into the building with no collision effects in violation of the laws of physics, so that what we have as proof is that in the various films we have of Flight 175 encountering the South Tower, for example, the plane disappears its entire length into the building in the same number of frames. It passes its whole length through air, which is a physical absurdity unless a massive 500,000-ton steel and concrete building provides no more resistance to the trajectory of an aircraft in flight than air. The three theories were that it was done with CGI, computer-generated images.
It's called phantom technology. Otis Johnson, excuse me, told me that it was phantom technology that we have. They can shoot it off of satellite. They can shoot it off of an aircraft, fighter jet, 40, 50 miles away. And it looks like an aircraft, the image that they're putting on, it looks like they're being bombed on or whatever. He said it was phantom technology was used on the fake planes. Go ahead, Jim.
No, it was actually an airborne holographic projector that allows an aircraft, which was flying 1,200 feet to the right of the projected image, to project the image, which is how it could be the case that a Boeing 767 was traveling at 700 to 1,000 feet faster than was aerodynamically possible. They committed the blunder of assuming it could travel at that lower altitude, this cruising speed at 35,000 feet, where the air is only one-third as dense. A point John Lehr makes in his affidavit is because the air is three times thicker, it can't be processed through the turbines, which begin functioning as brakes. Now, pilots for 9/11 Truth, which has done absolutely brilliant work on the aircraft on 9/11, actually ascertained that the speed that we see the plane flying in the various videos is too fast for its structure to support. That would come apart physically in the air. But what actually was there and didn't come apart was a holographic image being projected by the plane, which is why it's flying at an impossible speed, why it makes an impossible entry, and even noses out the opposite side in a hand-eye coordination problem. The nose of the plane came out the opposite side of the South Tower, which is preposterous because the nose of the plane is the most fragile element. It contains all the electronics. It would have been the most easily destroyed, and the networks faded to black. So you have the most historic event in recent American history being covered by television, and they fade to black at a crucial moment because they didn't want to conceal the fakery that was involved. A brilliant guy from the UK by the name of Richard D. Hall prepared what he's called his Flight 175 3D radar study, during which he took 27 of the 52 videos we have about Flight 175 that were sufficiently precise to plot specific locations and times of the plane as he approached the building. He would discover that NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, had similar plots that they claimed was based on radar data, but the data they provided looked phony to him. He discovered there actually was radar data, but oddly enough, it was for a plane traveling 1,200 feet to the right of the image that he had plotted, leading him to speculate about exactly how it was done, where he had it just right, and where I was subsequently sent a page from an Australian military manual for an airborne holographic projector showing what Richard D. Hall had discovered, one aircraft projecting the image of another and describing exactly the functions and purposes it would serve, including distraction and psychological operations. We know, by the way, that it had to have been a hologram rather than CGI or video compositing, which involves adding the images of the planes between the time the footage is first filmed and the time it's released to the public 17 seconds later. Because if either CGI or video compositing had been used, there would have been no image to see in real time. And yet we have around 500 witnesses who reported seeing what they took to be a plane. Their variation in their description, some said it was a large plane, some a small, some a military, some a civilian. But you could have had no images of the plane in real time before the broadcast and CGI or video compositing been used, since then the plane images would only have appeared upon broadcast. So that appears to be how it was done, a fascinating form of deception. No plane crashed at Shanksville, and no plane hit the Pentagon either. In fact, two of the planes weren't even in the air that day. Flight 11, North Tower, and 77 Pentagon were not even on the Bureau of Transportation Statistics records, which they keep for every single commercial flight in the United States, including the boarding time, when it pulls away from the gates, when it does wheels up, when it does wheels down, a brilliant blues musician from Australia discovered that there were no entries in the Bureau of Transportation Statistics records for either Flight 11 or Flight 77.
And yeah,
they weren't even
if
in
I
the
could throw something at you real quick. You know, Russ Wittenberg is one of the pilots on the day of 9/11. He's a former military pilot, et cetera. I've had him on a few times. He's in agreement with you 100% in this area. Now, one of the things is that there was a reporter, and I had it on my old website. I tried to put it up with this broadcast. A reporter was in Cincinnati, Ohio, I think it was, or Cleveland, Ohio, whichever it was, at the airport. And he sees the tail number of the particular flight that he just saw on TV reportedly hit the Twin Towers. And they took it to the NASA Research Center at the airport port. He immediately posted it up on Associated Press. Later, it disappeared. I have that article. So, and I had asked Otis, I had asked a whole bunch of people, spooks that were telling me they were planning this 3 months, 6 months in advance. But 3 months prior, I was blowing it out that we were going to have a terrorist attack. And this stupid, twisted FBI stooge, Israeli stooge, Alex Jones comes out. Oh, yeah, we might have a false flag attack before September. Because I was saying it. He knew it. He was told of it. Now, it's just... Go ahead, Jim. I give you credit. You have done the best research on 9/11. That's the reason I ask you to be here. I'm just kind of injecting a few things on occasion. And Paul, I want you to do the same. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, I appreciate that, Stu. I did on last Sunday a rather thorough and detailed video presentation about 9/11, where you can see all the evidence that substantiates what I'm reporting here, and how it was done, who was responsible and why. You can find that on my website, jimtheconspiracyguy.com.
Okay.
You can find it on my blog at jamesfetzer.org, embedded in an article entitled on C-SPAN, Richard Gage Leaves 9/11 Truth in a Time Warp, and you can find it on Twitter on my account at Jim Fetzer.
Good. Thank you, Jim, for giving our audience that. Go ahead. Paul, do you have any questions to this point before we let Jim run on? I mean, he's an encyclopedia here at this.
A tour de force. Absolutely brilliant, excellent summary. I would just like to add a couple of things. One is false flag, of course, but tell a big lie and tell it over and over again. Just repeat it. And for instance, fast forward today, you've got all of these ceremonies, and so you perpetuate the lie as if it was legitimate. And one, Donald Trump is certainly participating. He was at Shanksville today, and one of the more curious things that I heard after 9/11 was that Donald Trump was on the radio, and he suggested no way could those planes knock down those buildings. And he as much as said, hey, not possible, didn't happen like they said it happened. And then I really thought during Trump's campaign, certainly during the debates, he certainly led on that nothing about 9/11 was true. You know, you have the official story and then the alternative story, and then you've got all the shills involved, and very few have the capacity that you have, Stu, Russ Wittenberg, and Jim. I agree with Stu. I think you're the preeminent authority on it, so I'm enjoying this. I want to just add one other comment, and that is we can all come up with dates for the takedown of America, but I think 2001 may be the final straw, so to speak, because that was the beginning of the surveillance society. And so what you get is the Patriot Act, And of course, they can surveil us, and they create the TSA, and on it goes. And so here we are today, and they're celebrating that we have given up our freedoms. And people not only gave up their freedoms to go through airports, but now we're wearing masks. And I don't want to get off 9/11, but wow, things have not gotten better.
They haven't gotten better. And, you know, Daddy Bush said one time, I call him Dad Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush. He said that Al Martin, the Iran Contra whistleblower, who I got his book published, The Conspirators, it's a fabulous read, folks. He said the bigger the lie, the more the American people are going to believe it. Little lies, they don't believe. He said, as long as we can perpetuate the lie and make it bigger, they'll believe it.
That's right, because the public is used to telling little lies, but could never imagine telling whoppers such as the government will tell us, whether it's about
9/11, Sandy Hook, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You're correct about this, Jim. Go ahead. I want you to finish your report on this, because this is very significant, add to what Paul has said as well.
Well, let me add a few more ingredients. It turns out that pilots for 9/11 Truth were very resourceful and tracked air-ground communication for the two planes that were actually in the air. Flight 93, for example, they discovered was over Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, after it had officially crashed in Shanksville. Flight 175 was over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, after it had allegedly hit the South Tower. I myself obtained FAA registration records for every plane in service as to when it's taken out of service, when it's deregistered, and the aircraft that were used for those flights. Where the same plane, of course, can be used for different flights on different occasions today, from Tampa to Chicago, to Mao, New York to San Francisco. Both of those planes were taken out of service or formally deregistered on 28 September 2005. Raising questions such as, how could planes that weren't even in the air have crashed on 9/11, flights 11 and 77, and how could planes that crashed on 9/11, 93 and 175, have still been in the air 4 years later? Indeed, just to reflect the enormity of the scam and the complicity of the FBI, half a dozen of these guys, the alleged suicide hijacker, stood up alive and well the following day, and yet the American public had trouble ascertaining that if they were alive and well, then they didn't die in suicide crashes, and if they didn't die in suicide crashes, then the passengers aboard those planes didn't die in crashes that didn't take place, which meant that the whole war on terror was a fabrication and a fake to justify U.S. entry into the Middle East to conduct wars against those Arab states on behalf of Israel.
I'm pretty much in agreement with you on the Israel side of it because of the tracks of Israel all over the board on 911. Now, Jim, do you know anything about the financing and where it came from?
Well, I'm sure you know some aspects, but Saudi Arabia was involved in some of the financing. I have a good friend, by the way, a former Army intelligence psyop officer by the name of Scott Bennett.
Yes, I know Scott. Great guy. Go ahead.
Yeah, he got railroaded and wound up in a media security or prison with Brad Birkenfeld, who happened to know all the financing for 9/11. So whereas they were trying to quiet or silence Scott because he was speaking out against abuses of the military, that he actually became a far more formidable foe by learning all the intricacies of the financing, which he would eventually publish in his book, Shell Game, which he shared with many members of the Congress, but who have made no effort to act on that basis, even though it's very detailed and specific. So this is all quite stunning stuff.
Scott worked in the same building as Edward Snowden. Whistleblower Ed Snowden's in hiding in Russia, got caught up in Russia, had to stay there. Snowden needs his day in court, and what happened in that building? Scott Bennett, Dr. Lieutenant Scott Bennett, needs his day in court on what happened in that building. Rumsfeld folks, Secretary of Defense, filled the top door with secret Pentagon documents. Eyes only shit. And gave the Israeli Mossad access to everything, which they were in there every day collecting documents. The whole thing needs to be investigated. Top secret espionage to its max. Scott Bennett needs justice. So does Snowden.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Stu. These are both, in my opinion, heroes.
Major whistleblowers. Scott spent 38.5 months in jail. That's bullshit. They had me for 10.5 months causing 4 congressional investigations up their ass, keeping 5 Silverado holding Denver Airport. Scott Bennett got it just because he was working in the building investigating terrorist money. Now, I'm aware 911 is financed by the Isley Brokerage in Las Vegas, Nevada, which was Iran-Contra Silverado Neil Bush money, transferred to J.P. Morgan, Isle Jersey, Bahamas, Isle Jersey, HSBC Bank, then to three banks in Switzerland, in Basel, Switzerland, etc. There were 2-3 banks, went to Isley Brokerage, and to the Waymark Foundation, owned by my ex-father-in-law, Leonard Bowman, one of the 12 disciples of Satan, as Super Spook Otis Johnson used to call him, when he lived in L.A. for thousands of years, Stu, he was just the host body of Palm Angel. Now, that money went into the terrorist operation of 911, and I can prove that. I also can prove the death ray hit the building. I also can prove other things pertaining to 911. And the question is, as I ask, why did they put the cooling towers on the exact spot? You know, that fountain goes waterfall into a big hole where the tower sat. Otis told me 3 years after the tower got burned, he said the reason they put the water cooler was because they cut a hole to the center of the earth with the death ray, that it keeps eating the matter until it gets there. They needed a hole for Manhattan. Whether that's true or not, to the center of the earth, the hole is that Admiral Burtis reported on, wrote a book about, 2 Air Force jets under U.S. Air Force whatever it was, in 1952, chasing saucers, flies in the center of the earth to the North Pole. KGB's got a video or did hell up on Google showing the North Pole being open 60 kilometers wide, etc. If they cut that thing and they had to cool it to keep the matter cool from catching Manhattan on fire, that's a very interesting subject in itself, Jim.
Well, I think you might have a tough time convincing a physicist of a Hall of Worms, because that would mean the mass of Earth would be terribly different and we wouldn't be in the orbit around the sun we're in, based on calculations using classical Newtonian physics, too. But let me just say how much I appreciate having the opportunity to join you and Paul today. And as I have already observed, those who want to see a very detailed, very thorough 2-hour presentation where the images, the photographs, and the diagrams are so important, then you can find that at jimtheconspiracyguy.com or on my blog at jamesfetzer.org, embedded in the article on C-SPAN, Richard Gage Leaves 9/11 Truth in a Time Warp, or on Twitter at Jim Fetzer. It's always a pleasure to join you, Stu, especially on a momentous occasion such as this.
It's my pleasure, too. Now, Jim, you don't know the details of 911 that you have not witnessed?
Stu, I could go on for 3 hours.
We're 35 minutes. Will you stay here for 1 hour and answer more questions? And Paul can join us that way.
Stu, I'll tell you the problem. This is my fifth show, and I'm wasted. I'm just wasted. So, you know.
Okay.
That's why I'm suggesting, and because the visual evidence is so profoundly important, it is clear that the mode of destruction of Building 7 and the Twin Towers were completely different. Building 7 came down in a classic controlled demolition. All the floors came down at the same time. There was a pile of debris equal to 20% of the original 47 floors, or 5.5 floors, which is typical of experience with controlled demolitions. Even Dan Rather on 9/11 observed that this looked just like the controlled demolitions we've seen at the casinos and resorts in Las Vegas. He was spot on at the time. But the Twin Towers were blowing apart in every direction from the top down. All the floors remained stationary until they were blown to kingdom come, in the memorable phrase of Morgan Reynolds. The buildings were being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust, and when it was over, Stu, there was nothing there. His father, Frank Morales, a first responder from St. Mark's Episcopal Church, reported to me twice on two different interviews on an earlier radio program of my own. Those buildings were destroyed to or below ground level. When they were 110 stories, had they collapsed, there would have been 12% of 110 stories in debris, or 13.5 floors, which were not there, indicating they were destroyed by a completely different causal mechanism than took out Building 7. This is one of the glaring, striking features about 9/11 that is widely suppressed. It turns out that Rudy Giuliani had a command and control center two floors in Building 7, that Barry Jennings, who was from the New York Emergency Management, went there, discovered half-eaten sandwiches, still steaming cups of coffee. A fireman came along and said, "We got to get you out of here." While he was inside the building that morning, explosions were going off. A stairwell was blown out from under him. At one point, he felt himself stepping over dead bodies, which he could not see, but he could feel. When he got out, he was interviewed by reporters and explained what his experience had been. One of the glaring weaknesses of the 9/11 Commission report was that it did not even mention Building 7, which obligated NIST to conduct a whole separate report, which it would maintain that very modest fires had been responsible, which was a physical impossibility. Barry Jennings, who was in a position to contradict the report based upon his own direct personal experience, died just days before the report would be released.
Now, the firemen were digging for bodies and everything until they found $200 million worth of gold that was in that building. And then they were told to back off by Giuliani. And a fireman even got into it with police, because the police were ordered to have the fireman taken off the building. Once that gold was found, the gold was removed. Firemen were arrested. Later, the charges were dismissed against them. There's a lot of questions on what went on. But I do know that they used Area 52. S4, they use the death ray, and that's run by E-Systems, Dallas, Texas, Daddy Bush's company called Raytheon Corp, who had an S4 in Nevada, out there west of Las Vegas, the top secret place where the alien base is at, Papoose Lake, Nevada, but in Green Lake, Area 51 area, because my father's company, Bendix, who built toys for the government here in Kansas City, and he was one of the vice presidents of the company when he retired, never told me what they ever did. Never will. Top secret. Clearance above the president. They had a place out there to test toys. Raytheon had a place. Otis Johnson called me the day after 911 and said they hit the fucking building with a death ray. They used the generators off the Hoover Dam, which is about 8 to 10 of them out there, and all of them go to S4, the secret base. The secret base, they call it Area 51 and all this. Those are test sites. There's all these different companies that have test sites out there. But they used the generators off the Hoover Dam. Only two of them go to the civilian side, downstream, in California, Arizona, Nevada, for electricity. The rest of them go to the top secret military base, known as S4. That's where they bounced the death ray. And they made it from the Innslaw software. And today, Jim, for your own notification, stop secret shit. Why did the president, nearly 2 years ago, mothball all aircraft carriers and fighting boats? Why did he mothball them? Take them back to Washington State, to the naval base there, except for the one that sits in the Persian Gulf as a big show-and-tell thing with Iran. Because we have what's called, they show the picture of it, the USS Missouri, the USS Minnesota, the USS Wisconsin, the USS everything. All these new boats have been built since the mid-2000 time frame. It only takes 6 to 8 people to operate the boat. It goes 200 miles an hour across the ocean. It can become invisible, supposedly. And it has what's called the death ray on it. It could sit off the Long Island area, 300 miles out from the three boroughs of New York, they call it, Manhattan, etc. They can melt every building like the day of 9-1-1 on the island of Manhattan in 3 hours. 300 miles offshore, bendable lasers, bendable death ray. It cuts aircraft carriers in half in 3 minutes. That's the reason we mothballed everything. These are badass pieces of machinery. Everything being shot at it. Say the Chinese decide to attack one of them. And it's shooting everything off its aircraft carrier. It's got 20 airplanes out there, 15 missiles, rockets, everything. 50 caliber, 100, whatever they got. Bam, 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 bam. It automatically detects with its own computers. Sends the death ray after what's shooting at it. Dissolves all missiles. Then it goes for the original target, the airplane, and destroys it. The operators don't have anything to do with it. Self-contained. The operators inside, 6 to 8 of them, take the joystick and cut the aircraft carrier 7 miles away in half. That's how bad our military has become, folks. A death machine. It's called the death ray. Now, that's top secret. I'm aware. Take a look at the USS Missouri if you can find the picture on the internet. I tried to find it after I saw it on local TV. It's oval-shaped, Jim, and it's badass. And they tested that death ray on those buildings to see if it worked. You there?
I'm here.
Jim, you still there?